Well, Sunday evenings we're going through Mark's Gospel, and tonight we've reached the midpoint in every sense. We are, after all, in chapter 8, and there are 16 chapters in Mark, so that's halfway. But more than that, we're at the midpoint geographically. Up until now, Jesus has been in Galilee, he's been in the north, but from here on, he'll travel south to Jerusalem. And we're at the midpoint theologically. Now, Mark begins his gospel with a spoiler. He tells us what he's going to tell us. So chapter 1, verse 1 says, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." So we're told right at the start who Jesus is. He's the longed-for Christ. But then you won't hear Christ mentioned until chapter 8. In other words, Jesus is the Christ, or the Jewish word for it, he's Messiah. But for 8 chapters, Mark explores what that means. And he explores it especially through the eyes of the disciples. So chapter 4 and verse 41, we have this question. "And they were filled with great fear, and they said to one another, 'Who then is this that even wind and sea obey him?'" Says Mark, who is this who stills the storm with a word, who walks on water, who confronts and conquers a whole legion of demons? Who is this who raises the dead? Who is this who calls himself the bridegroom, when the only bridegroom the Jewish scriptures spoke of was God himself, the Lord betrothed to his people? And who is this who calls himself the Lord of the Sabbath, as though he owns the day, as though the day belongs to him? And who is this who speaks of new wine that will expand and burst old wineskins? That he's come to do something new, dynamic, different, and the old religion won't be able to cope. You can't pour him into your old ways. He's come to break the mold. And who is this who speaks with a matchless authority? And then he speaks to the crowd in parables, in riddles. And yet those parables separate the true followers from the false. And who is this who burns with unutterable purity and brightness, and yet opens his arms to welcome sinners? And who is this who forgives sins, who makes the unclean clean, who, when sinners approach him, find that the touching point is his gentleness? Who is this? And for eight chapters, the answer has been that this is the Christ. This is who he is. He's the King. He's the King to end all kings. He's the King who is taking over, whose kingdom is coming. Well, what's it like when the King takes over? What's it like when his kingdom comes? Well, says Mark, for 8 chapters, the blind see, the deaf hear, the lame leap for joy. And even death itself seems to go into reverse. This is the good news, the beginning of the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. Right at the beginning, says Mark, that's who he is. He's the Christ. But then for 8 chapters, we've been exploring just who the Christ is through the eyes of his disciples. Do you remember the feeding of the 5,000? We looked at that. Jesus feeds 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fish. Again, it's a miracle, it's a sign, it's speaking of who he is, that here is the shepherd king of Israel, who feeds his flock, who feeds his sheep. And then do you remember the feeding of the 4,000? 4 with its connotations, the 4 corners of the earth. Because he's not just Israel's king, he's not just the Jewish Christ. He's the savior of the world, and in fact Mark is writing to non-Jews, he's writing to Gentiles. He's the Savior of the world, the one who has come to put all things right. The one in our heart of hearts we've been waiting for. And of course, with 7 baskets of leftovers, there's more than enough for everyone. The Messiah has come into our desolate world, our desolate lives, to fill our emptiness with his fullness. Because no one who ever came to Jesus was sent away empty. Wonderful. But we're only halfway through the gospel. So we're at this midpoint theologically. And therefore, the passage that we had, and please turn with me to it, chapter 8, and verses 22 to 33. We're at the turning point of what Mark is seeking to teach us. Chapter 8 is the axis upon which Mark's argument turns. Yes, Jesus is the Christ. But that begs another question. What sort of Christ is he? And why is he going up to Jerusalem? What's his mission? Why did he come? And in those first 8 chapters, all those unanswered questions. A kingdom that will conquer all. A king who's come to put everything right. But how? How's it going to happen? How are we going to get from a wandering teacher with a little band of disciples in some corner of the Roman Empire? How are we going to get from there to the king seated upon the throne, whose kingdom will outlast the years? And how is this king going to satisfy the nations? And how will he deal with this great crisis that has brought into this world the misery of sin and the agonies of death and the terrors of the judgment that lies beyond death? How's he going to do it? How are we going to get from where we are to there? Such grand, glorious things, but how are we going to do it? Especially since those who are closest to Jesus, his disciples, don't seem to have a clue. So, that verse again, chapter 4, verse 41. They say, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? Okay. But then when we come to chapter 8 and verse 18, Jesus has to ask them because they still don't seem to understand. He says, having eyes, do you not see? His very intimate circle, those closest to him, when we come to these big questions, they don't seem to know what's going on at all. And he says in verse 21 of chapter 8, do you not yet understand? And so chapter 8, verses 22 to 33, is the turning point. Verse 18, having eyes, do you not see? And so now Mark goes on to talk about a man who cannot see, but a man who Jesus heals. But a man who Jesus heals in a very strange way. It's a strange miracle. And of all the record of Jesus' miracles, this one's unique. Because there's no instant cure. It's a two-stage process. So see if you can work out why Mark puts this miracle here. What Mark is teaching about Jesus' disciples. So the rest of the time we'll divide things into 3. Okay, so please have those verses open in front of you in the Gospels. And point number 1 is this. I see men, but they look like trees walking. They don't look like walking trees. None of us have seen walking trees. But they look like men. They're men, but they look like trees. And the men are walking, but they look like trees. That's what he's saying. So have a look at verse 22. And they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought him, a blind man, and begged him to touch him. We don't know who they are, but they know that Jesus is the miracle worker. They know that the touch is enough, that extraordinary touch of power. And they know that the blind sees. They bring this man, this friend, and they beg Jesus to heal him. Well, Jesus, as always, has compassion, verse 23. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. It's a lovely sight, picture, isn't it? Jesus holding this man's hand and saying, mind the step and out of the way, please. And just leading him gently out of the village, away from the noise, away from the hubbub. Takes him to a quiet place. And yes, Jesus is being sensitive to the needs of our blind man. But here's a lesson for the disciples, which undistracted, they must listen and look and learn. Well, they're out of the village. Now for the healing. But the way Jesus goes about it is quite unexpected. Verse 23, he spits on his eyes and he lays his hands on him. Why doesn't Jesus restore his sight with a word? Why spit? Imagine someone spat in your eye. And the hands, what's Jesus doing? Well, I'm sure all this made sense to our blind man. He's never seen Jesus. He's never seen Jesus' miracles because he's blind. He sees the world through touch. So Jesus will communicate his healing power through touch. Verse 23, and when he had spat on his eyes and laid his hands on him. The message is unmistakable, isn't it? It's Jesus' voice, Jesus' spit, Jesus' touch, Jesus' doing. So as this man feels these things, his trust is not just in the power to heal. His trust will be in the one who wields the power. Jesus himself. Now, having spat on his eyes and touched him, Jesus then asked a strange question, verse 23. He says, do you see anything? Now, normally Jesus doesn't need to ask, does he? Because usually the cure is instant and total. So is this a note of uncertainty? Is Jesus losing his touch? Does he somehow feel that his power is lacking? So he's saying to the man with a sort of anxious voice, do you see anything? Is it working? Has Jesus lost his touch? What do you think? Well, verse 24. And he looked up and said, I see men. But they look like trees walking. So Jesus' question elicits a response. Let's hope the disciples are listening. Because the answer is for their ears. It's also for our ears. Verse 24, and he looked up and said, I see men, but they look like trees walking. So he sees, but he doesn't see. There are shapes. There's movement. And since later on we talk about his sight being restored, it seems that probably he did once see, so that's why he can recognize things. There's shapes and movements, but it's not clear. Well, they're men, but they look like trees. So his world is changing, but we're at the midpoint. His world is turning from darkness to light. His world is going from blindness to sight, but it's changing by degrees. It's not instantaneous. In fact, verse 25, it's a two-stage process. Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Now he can see. The darkness is gone. His sight's been restored. Everything's clear. So have you worked out what the miracle is really about? It's a real miracle. It's a real healing. But, says Mark, it's also a commentary. It's a description. It's speaking about the disciples. For 8 chapters, the disciples have been with Jesus. For 8 chapters, they've witnessed the coming of the kingdom. They believe, as we'll see in a moment, that Jesus is the King. They believe he's the Christ. But we're only at the midpoint. We're only at chapter 8. Like the blind man after stage 1... they see, but they don't see. The disciples are no longer in the dark. They're no longer blind. But neither do they see clearly. They understand that Jesus is the Christ, but they don't yet understand what the Christ has come to do. at this midpoint, the disciples only see in part. I see men, but they look like trees walking. That's where the disciples are at the moment. And so in the second half of Mark's gospel, Jesus himself will complete the process. So that by the end of the gospel, they'll see everything clearly. Jesus is revealing himself to his disciples. But he's revealing himself to his disciples by degrees. That two-stage healing reflects, says Mark, the disciples' two-stage understanding. They've got who Jesus is. That's stage one. But they haven't yet got why he's come. As you shall now see, as you move on to point number two. But before that, verse 26. Oh man, what does Jesus do with him? He sent him to his home, saying, do not even enter the village. Why? Why the secrecy? Well, hold on to that question and we'll come back to it. So point number two, the disciples see, but they don't see everything clearly. In other words, at this stage, at this midpoint, they see men who look like trees walking. Look down verses 27 to 33. The scene moves. We leave Bethsaida. We move to the region of Caesarea Philippi. It's a predominantly non-Jewish area. It's a big Gentile area. Actually, it's a very pagan area. The crowds are far away. Time alone. Time alone with his disciples. So as they make their way along the road, Jesus asks his disciples a question. Verse 27. Who do people say that I am? So Jesus says, into which pigeonhole do people put me? Verse 28, and they told him, John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others say one of the prophets. Who do the people say that I am? Well, say to his disciples, there were three answers. Three religious answers. But actually three wrong answers. So when it comes to the identity of Jesus, popular opinion is wrong. All the answers fall short of the truth. And did you notice one of the answers is John the Baptist, the forerunner of the Christ. So whatever else people think about Jesus, one thing they're all sure about is that he's not the Christ. They're still waiting for the Christ to come. Well, verse 29, Jesus asks a second question, a leading question. But who do you, my disciples, who do you say that I am? After all the speculation, you who know me, what do you think? You've been with me from the beginning. We might say they've been with him for eight chapters. Who do you say that I am? Verse 29. Peter answered, you are the Christ. Peter's mind is clear. He sees what he's not seen before. He sees what the world beyond doesn't see. That here is more than a prophet, more than the forerunner. You are the Christ. Literally the anointed one. The kings of Israel at their coronation, they were anointed with oil. Well, here's the king we've all been waiting for. The final king, the king to end all kings. And on this lonely road, somewhere up in the north, away from everyone else, the disciples' eyes are opening. Verse 30, and he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. Why? Why the secrecy again? Well, hold that question and we'll come back to it. So chapter 8, verse 18, says, Jesus, having eyes, do you not see? Well, at last they do see, don't they? They are seeing, but how well do they see? Do they see everything? Or do they see men like trees walking? They're no longer blind and in the dark, but are they in the light? They appear to understand, you're the Christ. But how much do they understand? How well do they understand? Well, let's find out. Because having recognized that Jesus is the Christ, Jesus now begins to explain why the Christ has come. He's kept it quiet for 8 chapters. He said nothing about it. Now he's going to tell them why the Christ has come. In coming to put things right, to save the world, to fill our emptiness, to be the answers to our prayers, to establish his kingdom, says Jesus, this is how he's going to do it. And he began to teach that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. So for the first time, he's giving it to them completely straight. This is why I've come. This is what it really means to be the Christ. He tells them plainly. No ambiguity, no riddles, no parables. It's straight, direct, face to face. He tells them. And that word in there, verse 31, must. The Son of Man must suffer. In the original, it's a very strong word. It's a divine necessity. Jesus isn't predicting what's going to happen. He's not going to say, well, look, this is what's going to happen. He's spelling out what he has come to do. I have come to suffer. I have come to die. And to rise again. So he's the king. But the way to the crown will be through the cross. The way to the glory will be through suffering. The way to save the world will be to forfeit his own life. That's the way it must be. The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. And he said this plainly. Well, there's Peter. Peter, the man a little moment ago, saw clearly. Peter still thinks, I see clearly. And he's goaded by what Jesus says. And immediately he steps in, verse 32. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. As far as Peter's concerned, and Peter's thinking he's a Jew, and he's got the whole weight of everything he's ever been taught from his mother's milk about the Christ. He's been told that when the Christ comes, what will it mean? It'll mean the punishment of the wicked. It'll mean a renewed, restored Israel. Or Israel that's expanded to embrace the nations. And the nations will come to worship Israel's king. They'll come to worship the Christ. And it will mean the end of death and sorrow and the curse. And it'll be a new age, a golden age of peace and joy and blessing. Nothing less than heaven on earth. It'll be the long-awaited salvation. But not this. Not rejection, shame, death. And not at the hands of the most religious men in our country. At the hands of the elders, the chief priests, the scribes. What are you saying? Lord, you don't know what you're talking about. If you're the Christ, well, from now on, it's power, it's kingdom, it's majesty, it's glory. You're just right into triumph into Jerusalem. Don't start talking about suffering. And rejection and death. Who ever heard of a Christ? Lord, no more these embarrassing outbursts. You're going to undermine everything. Verse 33. But turning and seeing his disciples, his eyes upon them all, not just Peter, he rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. So does Peter see clearly? Do the disciples get it? No, says Mark. At this stage, they see, but they don't see clearly. They see men like trees walking. They can see that Jesus is the Christ. They've got that bit right, so they're not blind. They're not in the dark. They've got past stage one. They know he's the Christ. But they've yet to understand why the Christ has come and what he's come to do. They've yet to get through stage two. So just like our blind man who was healed in two stages, so for the next eight chapters, Jesus will fully restore their sight. So this healing is just a commentary on what's gone on. The stage one of the healing is the commentary on verses on chapters 1 to 8, and stage 2 of the healing is a commentary on chapters 8 to 16. That's why this is the pivot of the whole book. You've got the first bit, but now you must understand why the Christ has come, what he has come to do. It's not what you're expecting, says Jesus. But why is Jesus' rebuke so stinging? This is Peter, his right-hand man. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan." Because for Jesus, going to the cross is the ultimate nightmare. Everything inside Jesus recoils from going to the cross. So the temptation to avoid the cross is very real. And so if the voice is Peter's, the words are Satan's. It's the ultimate temptation. Don't go through with the cross. There are other ways. It doesn't have to be like this. And so Jesus slaps Satan down. Because if the temptation to refuse the cross is strong, his obedience to his Father's will is stronger still. And maybe now we understand why Jesus tells the blind man not to go back to the village. And why he strictly charges his disciples to tell no one that he's the Christ. Because if Jesus' right-hand man, if Peter of all people, gets it completely wrong about the Christ, what might happen if this information, if this news, gets into the hands of the volatile crowds? They might think, the Christ has come. They may try and put Jesus at the head of some popular uprising to overthrow the Romans. So don't say anything. The disciples ought to say nothing. It will be for Jesus himself, as we shall see later in the book, it will be for Jesus himself to break the silence. Time to close. Point number 3. Jesus asks a question, doesn't he? Hey, who do other people say that I am? Then he turns around and says to his disciples, who do you say that I am? It's the question we all have to face, isn't it? Who do you say Jesus is? What have we learned tonight? We've learned that when it comes to Jesus of Nazareth, most people get it wrong. Who do people say that I am? They said John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets. As we said, three answers, three wrong answers. So don't go on what people tell you. When it comes to Jesus, don't go on other people's opinions. Don't go on second-hand opinions. Find out for yourself. When you came and you were given the gospel, well, take it home, read it, find out. You know, it's not a cult, it's nothing secretive, some secret knowledge. You can find out for yourself, read it. We're starting Christianity Explored soon. Well, come along. Say, I want to know. People tell me who he is, but I want to know for myself. I want to find out. I want to know who this Jesus is. Just come, why don't you come along to the first get-together? No pressure, no hard sell. Just come, talk, find out what it's all about. Think, well, it might interest me. Come and find out for yourself who this Jesus is. What else have you learned? That even those who know who Jesus is don't always get why he's come. Verse 29, but who do you say that I am? Peter answered, you are the Christ. But then when Jesus spells out what the Christ has come to do, Peter says, oh Lord, you've got it all wrong. So you may see that Jesus is the Christ. In fact, you've never ever doubted it. You've heard it from your earliest days. You know he's the Christ, and that's he's the King, and that's so on. But maybe you don't see as clearly as you think you see. You don't really get why he came. You know, okay, you know he went to a cross and all that. I'm not saying you don't know that. But you don't really see how it all connects together. You see, but you don't really see. You're not in the dark, but neither is it clear. And you need that second touch to to open your eyes. What else have you learned tonight? That coming to know Jesus Christ as Lord and Saviour can take time. We don't see everything at once. We may see, but not see clearly. So if you're really interested in becoming a Christian, or you're serious about it, well, sometimes it takes time. It takes time for things to drop into place. And you may be tonight at the stage where you say, well, I see men, but they look like trees. And if that's where you are, there's a sense where we say, well, that's fine. These things take time. But what then do you need to do? We need then to ask the Lord, don't you? If you've been through stage one and you're beginning to get it and you're beginning to see a bit, well, Lord, touch me again. Open my eyes. I want to see clearly. I want to understand. I want to know who Jesus is. A little while ago, Sarah was baptized and we all heard a testimony. It was in Farsi, but it was delivered by Luna in English afterwards. And Sarah's testimony has been put in the Evangelical magazine. This is what she says. I had a real passion to know more about Christianity. I also prayed to God to show me the right way. And I suppose he did, because it was soon after that when I was encouraged to attend the church house party. Everyone treated me like a member of their family. And they had a great effect upon me. I was so passionate about learning the Bible. But when I was taught about the Trinity, I had many questions in my head like, how can God be three and yet one? And how can he have a son? I was torn between Islam and Christianity. But feeling closer to Jesus, I would talk and pray to him before going to sleep every night. And then she said she was always told that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship with God. So there you are, you see, she sees, but yet she doesn't see. But what does she do when she doesn't see? She keeps talking to God. I need to know, I need to know. She doesn't stumble, she doesn't stop when she hits difficulties. She doesn't say, well, there's a difficulty, that's the end of it then. The difficulties are to be overcome. She goes to Christ and says, I have a difficulty here. There are things I don't understand. You tell me, you show me, you open my eyes. And that's what you must do. Don't think, look, I've examined this Christianity stuff, or maybe I've been brought up in it, and there's this, and there's this, and there's this, and this, and therefore I've hit a difficulty, that's the end of it. Has it never occurred to you, it may be that you don't, it's there, and it's real, and it's true, the problem is your seeing of it. And the problem is not there, the problem is here. And you say, Lord, open these eyes. But keep talking to him, keep praying, keep speaking. Don't leave it. Don't let it go. Don't walk away. Because she goes on, doesn't she? We jump forward. The next Sunday, I went to the church and I was excited to share the good news. The spiritual transformation relieved me of my confusion. See? The confusion's gone. She sees it now. And on the 29th of August, 2009, I formally announced my true belief in Jesus Christ. And I decided I was going to give my life to him. It's the best decision I ever made. I found what I was looking for, and I believe that my life had gained direction and meaning since then. Do you see? She didn't leave it. Don't leave it. When you hit a difficulty, go to him. Ask for that second touch. It takes time. Ask Jesus to open your eyes. And what else have you learned? You've learned that Jesus came to die on a cross. The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. And he said this plainly. There's only one way to put the world right. There's only one way to put me right. And that, says Jesus, is the cross. If someone smashes your prize vase, and they say, I'm sorry. And you say, I forgive you. Who pays for the vase? Well, you'll have to pay for it, won't you? If it's real forgiveness, you say, yeah, I'll forgive you, but actually you'll have to pay for it. It's not very forgiving, is it? If it's real forgiveness, you say, I'll pay for the broken vase. They broke it, but I'll pay for it. Forgiveness doesn't come cheap. So you see, when we smash God's commands and we say, Lord, forgive me, God be merciful to me, a sinner, and he says, I forgive you, who pays? Who pays for those wrongs? When I smash God's commands, there's a price to pay. Who pays? The answer is Jesus pays. Penalty for my sin falls upon his head. And he dies the punishing death I deserve to die so that I can be forgiven. The Son of Man must suffer and die if sinners like you and me are to be saved. And then one final thing. What else have we learned tonight? That Satanism is not black masses and chopping the heads off chickens. Satanism is saying that the cross of Jesus Christ doesn't matter. He said this plainly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, Get behind me, Satan. If tonight you think the cross is unimportant, that I don't need a Jesus to die on the cross to save me, that I don't need a sacrifice for my sins, that I don't need the blood of the Son of God to pay the debt I owe for breaking God's law, if you think I can avoid hell without the cross, if you think that, you haven't got that from God. That's Satanism. So are you a Satanist? All the more reason to pray, Lord, open my eyes that I might see.